So have you guys ever wandered in this auditorium and looked at the sides and thought, why do they make it so ugly? Did you ever ponder this? I mean, is that not just hideous?
It's artistic, right?
Yeah. So, auditorium design turned out to be very much buried in physics. And I think there's some cool article that I'm asking you to read, or kind of article. It might be sort of fun. But it reminded me to tell you a story that happened to me, which really brought home the wave aspect of sound in auditoriums. So I collaborated for many years with a bunch of physicists running an experiment at Brookhaven National Lab. We actually collide goldens and I at extremely high energies, and when they would hit each other, they would go into all sorts of crap. So I often talk about it as inverse alchemy. Lead to gold, all the crap. What we were studying was when the gold nuclei, these energies go through each other, they would actually deposit a great deal of energy in a space, in a small space, and then that energy would turn into particles, and we effectively were studying something called quark-gluon plasma, which we believe was part of our universe about 1 microsecond after the Big Bang. So in a sense, we're studying the early phase transition in the universe. So it's a cool experiment. But that has nothing to do with my story. So we would meet periodically at Brookhaven, and one of the meetings we went into an auditorium in the chemistry building at Brookhaven National Lab. And I walked in and I sat down about right over here, and my colleague who sort of ran the experiment was standing up front, and he started talking. And he was talking. And I was sitting there, and I was like, I couldn't hear him. I got this huge jolt of adrenaline. Everybody else looked like they could hear it. I couldn't hear it at all. And I was freaking out. Oh my God, I just lost my hearing. I'm having a stroke. What's the deal? And I was literally freaked out. And I stood up, sort of needing to go talk to my friend right over here to see, make sure he could hear him or whatever. I stood up and I walked like a meter and I heard him just fine. I was like, oh. So I walked back a little, I couldn't hear him at all. Walked a little more, hearing fine. Walked a little more, couldn't hear him at all. And I was just, then I knew what it was, but I was absolutely amazed. I'd never run into something so dramatic. So what was happening was, here's my friend up in the front of the room, and here's this auditorium with the seats and everything, and his voice, it may be a mixture of different wavelengths, but you can sort of think of it as a more or less a particular pitch, a particular wavelength. And that sound was traveling as a wave to me over here. And another path for the sound was bouncing off of something over here and coming to my ear. And these two paths, you could think of one path being longer than the other path by a half a wavelength, or a half integral number of wavelengths, basically. So that I was getting pretty close to fully destructive interference where I was. And when I moved forward, then I broke that. The paths were no longer that degree of difference. If I moved backwards, they weren't. And so it was a very strange phenomenon. So, in case you've ever wondered why auditoriums have such ugly stuff around them, some worse than others, this is one of the more hideous ones I've ever seen.
Okay, do you want to say that? A little bit shit here.
Okay.
You can make it all.
That's fine.
Good. That's what I'm saying.
Thanks. The reason they do that is because they want to diffuse the sound so that it's coming to your ears from many different paths, so the probability of having dead zones is in interference. There. So a really good auditorium will diffuse sound, but not only that, it will diffuse all the various wavelengths of sound in such a way that you get a pretty flat response across the different wavelengths throughout the auditorium. So there's a whole lot of physics to acoustic design and auditorium. So the article will allude to that a bit. But that one time, I still sort of like, well, that was really strange. Very scary moment. So, hopefully you're not in dead zones in this class. So we've been talking about waves, and that's probably the most strange personal experience I've had with waves. But we talked about things that characterize waves as a whole. And in general, you can think of waves as exhibiting interference. So this is how they add together. So that was an example of that, because one was coming to me with the troughs and one was coming with the crests at the same time, and they would cancel out. They exhibit what's known as diffraction, and they exhibit refraction. And I guess you could also say they satisfy a wave equation. We won't do much with that, but I'll talk about it a little bit more in a little bit. It turns out that any sort of wave will satisfy, the solution for it will satisfy an equation that has a time dependence in space and time in it, and the wave which satisfies this is very characteristic mathematically. So interference we've talked a good bit about. Refraction is the bending of a wave at an interface. So I'm going to show you rays of light going through large lenses, and you'll be able to see the bending of the light at interfaces. But you can tell it's happening when you have a magnifying glass or something. What's happening is as the light comes in, hits the interface between the air and the glass at an angle that gets bent, and that's basically what magnifies things for you. It's the basis of lens. And I think I've talked and used the example of a marching band hitting a bunch of mud. It actually comes about because the wave phenomenon travels at a different speed in different materials. And so when you have an interface between materials at different speeds, you'll have this kind of strange bending. So that's known as refraction. Here's an example of diffraction. Okay, so what I have is a glass sheet with water, a thin layer of water on it, and then I have a bar that's about yay long. Think of it as just sort of a piece of a windshield wiper that's just being pounded on the top of the water. And since it's long, when it happens, what you see are basically these straight waves propagating across the tank. And you actually see the different shadows and stuff because of refraction, but I'm not trying to show you that. You can think of it as just different thicknesses of water. And so you can basically see the waves. If I want to slow this thing down, then you can see the waves. Now, diffraction is an interesting phenomenon. It is really the same thing as interference,
But a way to think about it is, if you have a wave coming in and it goes through a narrow opening, then it turns out that this piece of the wave and this piece of the wave will interfere with each other. And when they do, it will actually cause the wave that comes out to be bent, like so. Or another way to think about it is waves travel around corners, which is why if somebody's on the other side of the building, if you're walking toward Rush Reefs and there's somebody out around the other side of the building and they scream, even if there weren't other buildings where the sound would bounce off, you would hear it. You might not hear it as loudly as you would if you were on the side of the building where they are, but you'll still hear it because the wave actually will go around the corner. But here, if I take the water wave and I put it through a thin slit, you can see the flat waves come in, and then when they come out, you have it diffracted, it's called, so it spreads it out. If I narrow it down, you'll notice the spreading will spread out more. Starts to be a little harder to see. And it's better if I make it broader. See, as I broaden it out, you get a little spread here and here, but you still get sort of flat right there. So diffraction is something that becomes important when the opening is on the order of the size of the wavelength of the wave, whatever it is. So if I change the wave length somewhat, you'll see the effect changes a bit. So that is the refraction of a water wave. This is a laser. That's the light just coming out as a point, basically. And I now have a thin slit here. So I'll pass the light through a very thin slit. And when I do, you'll see the pattern change. The slit is narrowed this way, okay? So what that tells you should expect is to see diffraction that way if light is a wave. You will not see it this way because the slit is not thin that direction. And now I'm blocking it. Now you can see that what was just a round spot is spread out this way. If you have really good eyes, you'll see a little substructure here, but we'll talk about that at a different point. You see it? This is a classic demonstration that light is a wave. If light is a particle, particles don't diffract. It's a classic wave-like phenomenon. All right, so we have talked about electricity and magnetism And I think in the recitation this week, you played with bar magnets and their effect on our environment. And we've talked a bit about electricity visually, so things like static electricity and lightning. And these really seem to be very different phenomena. So I wanted to show you a couple of things. One is a little bit like you've already done the map. I have a piece of plexiglass, but now instead of a bar, what I have is just a wire that's going through the plexiglass, right? And I'm going to run an electric current through the wire. An electric current is nothing more than electric charges responding to an electric field that's in the wire. So that they feel a force and they do. So when I say electric charges, it turns out to be electrons in atoms that are sort of lightly held in metals. So all that's happening is I will turn on an electric field in the wire, which is basically what this battery does. And when I do that, currents will flow. I have no bar metal. Okay? And what you see scattered there are little iron filings. So if I turn on the current and I vibrate this a little bit, you can see the iron filings begin to take a pattern. And they're lining up around the wire. So if you believe that, what it's telling you is that when I have a current flowing, it creates a magnetic field in the space around it. Basically, for the charges to flow down the wire, I have an electric field that's this way. For these things to orient around it, I have to have a magnetic field that sort of circulates around that. So you can sort of think of it as if I have an electric field turned on, it creates a magnetic field going around it, sort of around that angle. So we can make that a little bit more real by, if I take a little compass needle, and it won't point true north in here because we actually have a lot of metal in the building that screws up the field. But let's say I have this compass needle. So whatever direction it happens to point, which I think is really pretty far from due north, but doesn't really matter. Because what I want to do now is to turn on this electric current and notice what happens to the compass needle. It changes. It didn't change a lot. I moved a little bit closer. Now I'm going to turn on the current. You can see it makes a big change in the compass. So there's a fairly deep relationship between magnetic fields and electric fields. So in that case, if I put a current in a wire, it creates a magnetic field. Now I'm going to look at something a little bit different over here, where what I have is a very powerful magnet, so that it's set up so that it has a magnetic field that goes from one pole to another. So you can think of one of these as being a really strong north pole and one of these as being a really strong south pole. And if I have a bar magnet and I put it in here, I probably couldn't move it out. I mean, it's a strong field. What I have here is just nothing but a wire. Okay, and you see If I just let it sit still, it sits still. All right. Now what I'm going to do is put a current through the wire. I'm not magnetizing it, I'm just putting a current through the wire. I took the current away, but if I put the current in, watch the wire. Okay. I put a current through here. That is, I basically am putting a changing electric field through here. And all of a sudden, the magnetic field, which is oriented this way, the way things is defined, it causes a force up at some weird right angle. Yeah.
Why does it go to that?
Why does what?
Why does it go to that magnet? Not the other one, or why did it turn?
Well, they're fringe fields up here, and so the directionality would be when you work it out. In here, where the field is pretty uniform, it really just goes straight up. Because it turns out to be a strange thing. If I have a current going this way, if I think of it as a positive current going this way, and I have a magnetic field going up, I'll have a force on the current that goes that way. It's a strange thing. It's a little bit early, but in about 2 weeks, you'll find your physics 14, 114 friends really suffering, trying to figure out these angles and everything. But the message here is, again, there's this apparently deep relationship between electricity and magnetism that we don't naively run into it every day. Come back to this one. Don't let me forget. All right, so if we have a current, usually we use the letter I. And we have a compass needle. You can see an effect on this compass needle. If we have a region where we have a magnetic field, which I label B, and we have a current going through there, there'll be a force on the current up that way. So there's this intimate relationship between the electric and magnetic fields, and pretty much, I mean, people knew pieces of this, but it was pulled together in a quantitative way by James Clerk Maxwell, and I'm asking you this week to read some stuff about James Clerk Maxwell. He actually did some pretty neat things outside of just this work. Maxwell took all that we know about electricity and magnetism and was able to relate them to one another in a series of equations known as Maxwell's equations. And we're not going to tear these apart to understand them, but I want to point out a few things, and I wanted to talk about the implications of it. One of the things, in these, the E is a symbol for the electric field and B is a symbol for the magnetic field. And one thing you'll notice is that this quantity that involves the electric field depends on the quantity that involves the magnetic field, and this symbol, this is a derivative, the calculus, it basically represents a change with respect to time. So what this really says is that if I have a changing magnetic field, it creates an electric field in the space around it. And there's a lot of directionality in this. It turns out if I have a changing magnetic field, it will change an electric field sort of at right angles to it. And similarly, if you ignore this, if we're in the vacuum and you have no current, this says if I have a changing electric field, it will create a changing magnetic field. So there's a self-coupling there that turns out to be very powerful. So in this equation, we find that what Maxwell did is instead of just dealing with an electric field or just dealing with magnetic fields, his equations show that electric and magnetic fields are unified in one framework. And there's a very deep relationship. And, well, this was done by Maxwell largely. But it turns out that with Maxwell, he didn't understand the deep relationship fully. The deep relationship was most well understood by Einstein and was the focus of his first real paper. So what Maxwell's equations sort of tell you I think I mentioned at the start of last time, at the end of class, is that if I have a changing magnetic field, I wiggle a bar magnet, for example, then it will create, in the space around it, it will induce a changing electric field. If I have a changing electric field, that will induce a changing magnetic field. So that's what this self-propagating, that's what this coupling does with these two equations at the bottom of Maxwell's, which I showed you. Changing B induces E, changing E induces B. So it's just self-propagating once you start it. So the example that I sort of gave last time was if I have a fistful of electric charge, for example, and I just move it up and down, then I will create in space a changing electric field, which will induce at right angles to it a changing magnetic field. And if you calculate the speed with which, so the changing electric field induces a changing magnetic field, which induces a changing electric field, which induces a changing magnetic field, and this whole thing will propagate out. And in Maxwell's equations, it turns out one of the things that we haven't talked about, but happens to also be true, is that if you take these equations, there's a piece here I didn't say, if you take these equations and you sort of decouple and you find a mathematical relationship for just B or just E, it turns out that what you get is that E and B separately satisfy a wave equation. So if you look at that wave equation, and one of the things that all the wave equations have within them is the speed of propagation of the wave, and you calculate the speed with which the electric field or the magnetic field propagate in time, it turns out to be the speed of light. Okay. So it creates a mental model. It gives you a mental model of what light happens to be. So we can imagine my fist being here wiggling, creating a changing electric field, which creates a changing magnetic field, and this whole thing propagates outward. It's really complicated close to my fist because I'm wiggling it and you have the field changing in sort of a complicated spherical way. You could imagine having an electric field that has a fixed string around this charge that's spherically symmetric, and that's what's wiggling. And so it's going to create a sort of a complicated change in the electric field in the space around it, which Maxwell's equations will describe, and in principle you can figure it out. But it's really a lot simpler if we look at this phenomenon from very, very far away. And a way to think about it is if I drop a rock into a pond, I have a circular wavefront coming away from that rock. That's complicated. If I get 100 yards away, if it's a big enough rock so that I can still see the wave, that circle becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so by the time I'm very, very far away, when I look at the wave, when it hits me, it looks like a flat wave coming in. It's just like Earth looks flat to us, basically, even though it's a big sphere. So if we look at this phenomenon from very, very far away, then what you see is something that looks like a plane wave, we call it. Where did I put that? Here. Okay. So if we're very, very far away and we calculate what Maxwell's equations tell us we should see if something is changing in electric field. So now instead of just a fist, let's just imagine that something has an electric field going up, so I have an oriented charge to do that, and then it comes down and then it orients it the other way. So it really just is doing this back and forth. Okay? Then that would be what's represented by these arrows as it sort of propagates outward away from the source. The source is very, very far away. And what's happening is when I have a changing electric field in space, it generates at right angles to it a changing magnetic field. This is sort of a deceptive picture in the sense that what you really want to picture here is to think of because the source is way over there, what you're seeing is the face of a sphere that's really big coming through your eyes, basically. And instead of looking at whatever it is our eye senses to, imagine that you're able to see the strength of, and direction of the electric field in that plane as it passes through your eye. And that's what you're looking at right here for the green. And then that thing continues to propagate through, and this moves at the speed of light. But what you see in this plane is the strength of the electric and magnetic field as it oscillates, as it passes your plane of sensitivity. So the transverse confinement of this thing is a little bit artificial. It's not meant to say that this phenomenon is located in some small transverse thing. It's not a beam. It's telling you that you have this plane from the source that's far away, and these arrows describe within each of the planes, successive plane, what the electric and magnetic field are doing as a function of time. This is actually what Maxwell's equations tell you happens. If I wiggle electric charge and I go very, very far away and I ask, what do I see? What I see is this propagating thing where I have the electric field and the magnetic field oscillating back and forth and propagating outward, and the speed of this propagation is at the speed of light. And that is really the essence of what Maxwell tells us. about what light happens to be. If I wiggle things faster, then they oscillate faster. The wavelength of this shortens. So what this is telling you is that light is a wave. That it has a wavelength, and it propagates outward just like a wave on water. But it's a very, very special wave. At the time, it was assumed that this must be oscillating in something, which they called the ether. And the nature of what ether is and how the electric and magnetic fields oscillate in it, nobody understood. But it turns out that this happens just fine in the vacuum. We have no evidence of ether. If ether were there, it would be a material that we could measure our speed with respect to, and we would be able to measure, see, the speed of light would be different depending on your motion. But it's not. Michelson and Morley showed that's not the case, and then Einstein managed to understand the fact that if you see the speed of light to be the same in all reference systems, you know, then you get strange effects on space and time. But now this is on clean footing. So what Einstein actually showed was that there is no ether. There's no need for ether. So what's happening with this wave is that a changing electric field induces this changing magnetic field, which induces a changing electric field, and all this happens propagates out the speed of light, and it doesn't need material to oscillate. So one sort of strange thing that I find very interesting is that when we initially started talking about magnetic fields and electric fields and gravitational fields, it was just a mental game. I have this charge. What does it do in space such that when I put another charge here, it feels a force? We say it creates an electric field there. It's a calculational convenience to have it there. It turns out to be a very powerful way of doing lots of calculations. But it is literally pulled out of thin air. And now, all of a sudden, we learn a lot more, and we find out that we have this totally new phenomenon which seems to make the electric and magnetic fields have a reality that you would never have thought of initially. So now, you know, is that field real? Before I knew about light, I'm not sure I would have thought of it as real. But now I look at this, I go, wow, because I'm not talking about charge or magnets here. This phenomenon exists in a sense. I mean, perhaps to get it started, I have to wiggle a charge or something like that. But basically, Maxwell describes light very well. You can now, from Maxwell's theory, you can derive the laws of optics. So it's extremely powerful. You guys doing okay? So, at the risk of putting you to sleep a bit, I have the graphic thing that's just too cool not to show. Have you ever heard of polarization? So, if you're dealing with light, polarization is defined to be the orientation of the electric field. So, in this case, the electric field is going up and down, and the magnetic field is going side to side. Okay. Imagine I take two waves of light, one with the electric polarization one way, one with the polarization the other way, and they add together. And so when they add together, because they're right now I'm not picturing, there's no magnetic field here, so I think of it as I'm only picturing the electric wave part, the electric field part, two different waves. They're at right angles to each other, so when they add together, being the same kind of field, they'll actually create this purple thing. So if your eyeball was right here, and you look at the sum of the blue and the red as it passes through your eyeball, you would see something like this. Okay? If I change the timing of one wave relative to another, you can get all sorts of weird effects with this electric field. So I don't know if you've ever heard about it, but you can have, initially the field was just doing this. You would call it linear polarization because the electric field of the wave is just moving back and forth on a line. This would be an example of what would be circular polarization because these things are sort of changed in time. You actually get the electric field as it goes through your eye to be moving in a circle. So it's sort of a strange thing. It's a basis of a very powerful chemistry diagnostic where you can put material and send light through it, and some materials will actually change. They have different speeds for the light depending on how it's oriented. So they can change the speed of light this way relative to that way, and they can do things like induce circular polarization. Another way to think about it is you can create materials that preferentially let through one polarization of light. So if you buy sunglasses that are polarized lenses, when light is reflected off of puddles or off of adjacent car windows, it turns out that it is reflected in a polarized way. So if light is coming in with all different orientations for the electric field, the only stuff that gets reflected happens to have one orientation. If you then put in front of your eyes a material that cuts out that polarization but lets the other polarizations through, it will cut out that light. And so that's why if you have Polaroid lenses and you put them on, it cuts out the glare from puddles and windows, but not other things, because it's only cutting out those things which are reflected with a certain polarization. If you take those same lenses and you do this, you'll find they don't do any good. Because now it's letting that particular orientation through. If you take two lenses, Polaroid lenses, if you take your little brother's lenses and you break them, and you have his glasses, and you line them up like this, and then you take one of them and you turn it at right angles, it turns totally black. Because one of them lets light through one orientation, the other one lets light through the other one's orientation, and you end up with nothing. I don't know how interesting you guys find that, but I think it's sort of cool. All of these are sort of illustrations of the wave nature of light. Okay, so I would like to do a demonstration that sort of shows a little bit the need for relativity when it comes to electricity and magnetism. If I have two charges and I ask you what is the force between them, then you might say, well, it's the electrical force, because we know from Coulomb's law, for example, that the bottom charge creates an electric field where the top charge is, and it feels the force. And, you know, from Coulomb's law, one can actually even calculate. But let's imagine now that we look at the same thing, but we're running past it at large speed. If that's true, we're not really just seeing two charges. We're seeing what I would call two currents. That's really what you mean, is current. And if I were to go a little deeper in electricity and magnetism and ask how do I interpret a force between two currents, the way that I interpret that is I say that this current sets up a magnetic field in the space around it, which you've seen happen. And then you've seen, if I have a magnetic field and I run a current through it, it feels a force. So if I have this current going and it sets up a magnetic field in space around it, the fact that I have this current going in, it'll feel a force. So one's interpretation of the physical phenomenon depends on your reference frame.
Yeah. So you're saying if you're moving by stationary charges, you're going to see that there's a current running there.
That's a way of looking at it. The caveat here is the way this is set up, if I just run past bare charges, then these, what would look like wires, would still have a net electric charge. But I can set it up so that I basically have the same number of positive charges as I have negative charges, and then go run past that. So basically, I end up creating a current. And you actually do get a force. So I have uncharged wires right here. And what I'm going to do is put a charge between them. So watch them carefully, because it's a small effect, I think, when I have it go in this direction. Okay, so I'm going to 1, 2, 3, connect it, and they move toward each other. If I change it so the currents are going the opposite way, it turns out to be a little more dramatic. Not at all. Yeah, well, they just move apart. But there is a force between these wires, which, when you're dealing with just the currents, and you have things set up so that you effectively don't have any net electrical charge on them, the current flowing through one of them sets up a magnetic field in the space around it. And if I have a magnetic field and a current flowing through a wire, it feels a force. Okay? So I guess in order to present it a little more carefully, this phenomenon happens. It means if I have two currents in space, there's a force between them. And I can interpret that force and calculate that force using what I understand about magnetism and how it's created by currents and how currents moving through magnetic fields are affected. If I have two stationary charges, I can interpret the force between them as being from basically Coulomb's law or electrostatics, electric force. These really only differ by your relative frame of reference. If you're standing by the charges, you would interpret it this way. If you go running past them, you would interpret it that way. So one of the things this tells us is that not only is there basically a deep relationship between electric and magnetic fields, it tells us that what you mean by an electric and magnetic field, or how you interpret it, depends on your frame of reference. So not only do we have space and time changing as our frame of reference changes, electric and magnetic fields also transform. It turns out their transformation is more complicated than the one that I've showed you with space and time, but that's just a conception that doesn't really matter. So I can see an electric field in space here, and if I'm moving very fast by a rocket ship, I'll actually see that electric field having changed in its strength, and I may see a magnetic field component to it that I didn't see if I wasn't moving. So it's a very strange sort of new world again. And this really is the basis of Einstein's 1905 paper that established relativity in this sort of it is the answer in the end as to what light looks like if you're trying to move very fast.
And what if someone's sitting next to it and someone else is running by it?
You would interpret it
if they had, but they had something to interact with. You know, because you can say you ran by it and created a field, and the other person was holding something to detect you, but not moving. But you ran by it and they detect you.
Your interpretation of it would be different. But the physics, what would happen would be the same in terms of it. It's like
there would be something, the person sitting still, something would happen, but it would look differently to him than to the person running by. But something would happen, it would be.
Well, if something happens in one frame, then something will happen in the other frame. So the basic essence of cause and effect and something happening doesn't change. But what might change would be one person might look at it as purely an electric effect, and the other person might see it as purely a magnetic or an electric, both magnetic and electric combined. So it just becomes more complicated. So what happens with electric and magnetic fields is as complicated as what happens. It's more complicated than what happens in space and time. So it's very bizarre. So, happily, this strangeness happens because we have this enormous richness with these waves. Often when people say light, and they're not a physicist, they mean visible light in particular. It turns out that your eye is sensitive to a very fixed set of wavelengths, or since light moves at c, frequencies. Okay? And in terms of wavelengths, our eye is sensitive to wavelengths that are sort of about 1 micrometer to almost 0.1 micrometer in size. And the shorter it is, it looks bluer. The longer wavelengths within this tiny little range look redder. If the wavelength of the light is a little bit longer, remember the relationship between wavelength and frequency for light is that the speed of light, which is a constant, is equal to its wavelength times its frequency. So high frequency means it moves up and down very fast. The electric field is oscillating really fast, like 10 to the 14th times per second or something ridiculous. So it can be really, it can be arbitrarily high. And the wavelength then varies depending on what it is. And what you find is that there is a great deal of richness in how these particles interact. How light interacts with matter, how it passes through things, what you can do with it. So, visible light, this is a narrow range that our eye is able to see. As you go up in frequency a little bit, which is down in wavelength, then you enter a range called ultraviolet. Our eye cannot see it. You go a little bit further, you get into x-rays. Visible light won't penetrate your skin, but x-rays don't get stopped by your skin. Something dense like a bone can stop an x-ray, but that's why if you put film underneath a body and then hit it with x-rays, you can get an image of the bones, because x-rays don't get stopped. They're not sensitive to normal density matter. If you continue to go up in energy, you go to shorter wavelength and higher frequency, you hit a region which we call gamma waves. So these are enormously energetic waves. If you go on the other side, so you go to waves that oscillate more slowly and have longer wavelengths, then you get infrared. This is actually what you see as heat. And you can sometimes see pictures people take using infrared sensitive film, where they take pictures of a house, for example, on a cold day. And what you see is a lot of heat bleeding out at certain points in the house. It's a way of telling, for example, where you have good insulation and bad insulation. And you probably watched these, every now and then they have these shows of the cops chasing bad guys in some city with a helicopter, and the helicopter, you know, turns on their infrared camera, and they basically get a picture of the guy huddling in a bush down here. Because he's emitting a lot of infrared light. Nobody's eyes are sensitive to it down here, but if you're sensitive to infrared, it's glowing like just right there. You can see in the shade. So that would be infrared light. If you go where your wavelength is a little bit longer and your oscillation yet slower, it turns out this is the microwave region, and microwaves turn out to be... they interact with matter in such a way that when they get absorbed, they cause the molecules to vibrate more. And it turns out that vibrating molecules is a measure of how much energy that material is containing in terms of heat. So microwaves cook food because that frequency of light excites water molecules and makes them hot. So you literally cook something from the inside because you're literally starting to get all the water molecules vibrating with each other by having them absorb this light at this particular frequency. But the water molecules won't necessarily really get excited by other frequencies, higher or lower. So there are certain ways in which different wavelengths of light interact with things. Radio waves can go through most things. They have very long wavelengths. They don't penetrate water very well. You have to go to extremely long wavelengths in order to penetrate water very well. So if the wavelength is extremely long and it travels at a fixed speed, it means that you can... one way to think about it is... if you communicate by pulses of this information, pulses of this light, for example, if you want to communicate with submarines, you have to do it with an extremely long wavelength of light, which basically means your pulse is so long that it takes actually a lot of time for the pulse to travel, to be able to convey information to a submarine. So submarines have an issue, for example, if you want to communicate them when they're down deep, you have to do it. The only way you can get a wave that will penetrate through the seawater is to have its frequency be so low that, in fact, it takes a long time to communicate a message to them. So that's a real problem. So they usually have to rise up and put an antenna above the water, which you can communicate with one of these shorter wavelength things. Yeah.
When you say a long time, what do you mean?
I forget the wavelength they have. It can take minutes to convey very short messages, which can basically be done in a very, very, very short burst otherwise. So it's sort of a big deal. At any rate, so there's this huge richness. There's some other aspects of this which are sort of interesting. How do we take a picture? We take a picture by bouncing visible light off something. And then it comes up, and we may focus it or whatever onto a plane, which contains either electronics these days, or in the old days it would be a chemical that's sensitive to basically the intensity of the light. We'll look at it a different way soon, but you saw earlier that if I have a wave that goes through a hole that has a size that's on the order of the wavelength, that wave spreads out. So one of the things this tells us is that if I use visible light to image something that's smaller and smaller, at some point it's so small, the visible light is diffracted off of it. So it doesn't just look like a ray coming off, which would give us good position information. It comes off and it gets all bent. So there's a limit to how small a thing you can image with visible light. So there's a natural limit to what microscopes can do in that, which is caused by diffraction. So all optical instruments have this basic imaging limit, which is coming from the fact that we have light as a wave. So there's a whole lot of richness here. In terms of size, well, I mean, radio waves are going into sizes that are on the order of the size of a house or a football field. And you can go on down much smaller than atoms, etc. So a lot of variety to electromagnetic waves. So I talked about relativity. All right. So for lots of reasons, I hope you believe that light is a wave. And in fact, I think the writing this week is basically telling me why we think light is a wave. But there is no doubt that the mathematics that describes these light waves, which we call electromagnetic waves more generically, light is usually sort of reserved to talk about what's happening in that narrow range of frequencies and wavelengths that we can see as visible light. But in general, we call it electromagnetic waves or electromagnetic radiation. Now, I hate to use that word because that word has really bad connotations in society. In general, you start talking about radiation. But in physics, see, radiation is basically anything that's emitted. So this entire spectrum of light would be electromagnetic radiation. So although that word has tough connotations in society, you have to maybe ask a few questions if somebody's talking about radiation, because it can be something as innocuous as a flashlight. So refraction, diffraction, interference, and the basic mathematics that it satisfies, you can derive all of this from Maxwell's equation. And you can understand the characteristics of all these different frequencies of these light waves. So there's no question that light is a wave. The next class, I'm going to show you examples of refraction. Today we've looked at diffraction. We've seen some interference with waves on strings and things. So I'll show you some optical things next class to talk about refraction. But I sort of now want to move to a different stage. Any questions on light at this point?
So, if you grew up very much in the lakes, what makes it?
With that wonderful segue, what makes it a particle? That's exactly where we're headed. Toward the end of the 1800s, we had Newtonian mechanics, Newtonian understanding of gravitation, and there was nothing yet discovered that didn't fit Newtonian's gravitation. And we had Maxwell's equations through which we could understand all basic light phenomena and optics. Students were being told not to bother to go into physics because we know it. There's nothing left to do. Okay? So there were just some simple things people were trying to understand. One of those things happened to be the interaction of light with matter. Okay? And if you wanted to understand how light interacts with matter, what one of the simplest things you might try to do is to be able to describe the light that is emitted by an object. Now, you may not really think of it that way, but all objects are emitting light and absorbing light. What you generally see and you perceive and you think of as what you're seeing is that light is comes and it's reflected on something. And that also happens. Okay? But things also glow. So if you go and you turn on a standard burner on your stove, as it begins to warm up, what you see is sort of a deep red. As it gets hotter, that turns into a brighter red, a bit more orangey. If it gets hotter, it gets more whitish. And eventually, if you got hot enough, if you have a poker in a fireplace or something, you can even get sort of a blue glow out of it. That is light that this thing is emitting, right? You can sort of see it glow. That's very different from the light that just bounces off because that, you know, it looks black. So it's different. So it turns out the simplest thing you can sort of think of to study that has to do with how light interacts with matter would be what does the light look like that is simply emitted by a glowing object? And it's a little bit deceptive because when I talk about a glowing object, you think hot. Okay? You think hot because it turns out that things that glow with light in the visible region happen to be at about 3,000 degrees. They're hot. Okay. So, but everything glows. And so what you want to do experimentally is to create a situation where you look at the glow of something, but you don't allow light to come in and be reflected off of it. So when you have such a situation, we call it black body radiation. And you can sort of imagine creating such a thing by having a cavity here which has a little hole. And you basically put your eyeball up to that hole, or your detector, up to that hole. And then you look at whatever light you're seeing from the inside of this object, with no reflected light coming in. And you change the temperature of that object. And you look to see what the light looks like that comes into your eyeball. So this is sort of a picture of what we're talking about. So you have some sort of egg-like thing. You have a hole in the egg. I made it bigger here. I heat the egg up, and I then look at the intensity and the color. Color is represented by the frequency of the light. So I look at how the intensity of the light comes in as a function of its wavelength or its frequency. And I can plot it. And if I do that, and I do it for different temperatures, if I plot here wavelength of the light, and I plot the intensity of the light, what you find is that at low temperatures, I might see something that does this. And as I increase the temperature, I get more intensity, so it gets brighter, and the peak sort of shifts to higher frequencies. So you get this very characteristic curve for any material, depending on its temperature. And this is true at all temperatures, from absolute zero up to as high as you can imagine. All right? If you can put it in such a situation where you're not bothered by the reflective stuff. And there's a very characteristic curve that you see. And it is known, we call it black body radiation, because it's set up to where you don't have things reflecting on it. So it's a black body. And when you talk about this, how the frequency, how the intensity changes in frequency, we call that the black body spectrum. When you talk about how something changes with frequency or wavelength, how the intensity changes in frequency or wavelength, that's what a physicist called the electromagnetic spectrum of that object. It's a spectrum of different wavelengths. Okay. So this is very characteristic of what you see for these glowing materials.
So around the end of the 1800s, people had made these measurements. And they had also taken Maxwell's equations and their current ideas of what they thought matter was. So they knew that there were negative charges and there were positive charges. And so they sort of had a picture of like positive charge, negative charges in there that would vibrate to absorb or emit light. Because light is clearly a wave that's caused by sort of oscillating charges. So they had this sort of picture. And they took this classical picture and they tried to calculate the black body spectra and how it should change as you change the energy of this object as you heat it up. And what they found was it kept getting something that looked like that. No matter what they did, if they went to shorter wavelengths, it just went up infinite. They couldn't get the right answer. The best physicists in the world worked on this for many years, and nobody could get the right answer. Then along came a guy named Max Planck, and Max did something completely nuts. Max made an assumption. Part of the problem was as you go to higher energy or as you go to the higher frequencies, the wavelengths become shorter. And so it turns out that your solutions diverge when you're basically trying to create standing waves in these cavities or whatever. So Max decided to have the energy in the wave, instead of being wave-like, he decided to make a theory where it was like coming in little packets. And he made an assumption that the light, instead of acting like a wave, came in packets of energy H nu, where this is some constant. So the energy of the light would depend on its frequency, but it would be absorbed or emitted in a very peculiar way. Instead of sort of continuously being absorbed or emitted the way a wave would be, I mean, if you're standing in an ocean, you have this wave coming in, and if you want to absorb a certain amount of energy, you have to sort of integrate it over time. That will let it hit you for a little while. What he's saying is this comes in, and instead of like a wave, it comes in more like a pack. And when he made this assumption, he was able to derive exactly the black body radiation curve with no experimental deviation whatsoever from this theory. I mean, it was like absolutely perfect derivation of these curves. So then you have this very strange situation, which is you have this experiment that cannot be explained by classical wave theory. We know light's a wave, and there's umpteen trillion pieces of evidence to show that. And then you've got this piece that just doesn't fit it at all, and you've got this whack job over here who says, well, why don't we assume it's not a wave, but it's a packet, like a particle, and we do the theory that way, and look, it totally explains this perfectly. And so people didn't believe the interpretation. I have to go and read it again. I don't even know the Planck, I'll leave it. But nobody could deny that he had discovered the quantitative formula that describes this.
And nobody could deny how he got it, but clearly it was an accident. A sort of reality. But what it was it heralded the revolution that we call quantum mechanics. But at this stage, that was not what people were thinking. They were thinking, don't know how he got it. Cool formula. We need somebody smarter to figure out how to get that formula using light as a wave.
Sounds like people were kind of resentful.
I don't know.
Wait, you're resentful.
Well, I think at the time, I mean, it was one of these, like who does this guy think he is? I mean, I don't know about that. But there, his starting point was crazy. Because we know light is a wave, so it means we haven't been smart enough to figure out how to get that formula, which he's figured out. I mean, I think they really thought of it as a fortuitous accident at the time.
A good approximation.
Whatever. But we haven't had somebody smart enough yet to figure it out. So I have to stop there, but that's where we'll pick up Wednesday, is to sort of take that historical situation and look and see what happened next.